What happened?
There it is. It's back. Okay. We originally had scheduled for tonight Soren Kern, but he had to move to Spain 3 weeks ago, and so he couldn't make it. He says he'll be here next year. And then Bill Koenig said his wife has been ill and he couldn't fly here. So we're stuck with Randy Price. I'm just kidding. And Randy, I was going to let him do something tonight anyway because, you know, he's done all this archaeology stuff. But I met Randy in 1969 when I lived in Austin, and I was a first-year student at Southwest Texas. And he grew up in San Marcos, Texas. And I went to this Christian center there, and he and another friend of ours, Richard Chart, was there. And that's when I met him, 1969. And Randy, believe it or not, graduated undergrad in art.
Commercial art.
Commercial art, yes.
Starting pre-med, ended up commercial art.
And then he went to Dallas Seminary and majored in Hebrew, and he moved to Israel right after that and went to the Hebrew University for 2 years and learned to speak Hebrew. That's a good strategy if you really want to learn Hebrew and all that stuff. And then he got his PhD at the University of Texas at Austin in what?
Well, Jewish studies with an emphasis in archaeology.
Yes. And I helped convert him to using Mac computers back then. So, take it away.
No conversion because I hadn't even heard.
I know, but we went over, you know, they were selling them at somewhat of a discount, as if you could back then get a discount on a Mac, you know. But, yeah, and I helped him learn to start using it. But he soon passed me on that, so go ahead.
Well, I had a small presentation, and Tommy told me that he said, you have 3 hours. I said, oh, really? So I've added a little bit to it.
With the bathroom break thrown in.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the last time this happened, I was in Panama speaking at a conference with Tim LaHaye and Frank Peretti and who's the guy, the bondage breaker? Neil Anderson. And I was following that morning T.D. Jakes. What a lineup here, okay? And, of course, it was all in Spanish, too. And I got there. I had my little archaeology presentation ready to go. And the guy came and said, hey, it's too hot here for T.D. Jakes. He already left. You get the whole time. So I'm sitting here going all, and I'm just about to walk up on the stage. And I'm told I had double the time that I had. So it's okay. Yes, oh yeah. I'm immune to Tommy, that's all right. All right, I thought it'd be good for us, because we're focusing on current events, to talk about some of the current events facing Israel today, one of which is the political situation concerning Jerusalem and also concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we're going to look at the archaeology and the politics of Israel. It's a crucial thing. First part of our talk will deal with the issue of Jerusalem, the holy sites, the Temple Mount, and then we'll move to the Dead Sea Scrolls and my own contribution to that with an excavation at a new Dead Sea Scroll cave. And then we'll wrap it up, and our plan, I think, is to open this up later to the floor to discussion of particular current events. I don't have all the answers. Many of you have far more answers than I do. Let's look at something. A number of years ago, I was walking down the streets of Jerusalem and came across a poster shop and just kind of meandered in. And there was this poster that said, our future is where our past is. And the point they were trying to make with the modern archaeological beaker emerging from an ancient ceramic jar was that we're back in the place where it all began. Okay? Our future, which is what God promised, is in the very place where he started it all, right here in the past. Now, the problem with connecting the past and the future is that you have the present in the way. And that's what we're dealing with when we talk about current events. For instance, here's an article from the Jerusalem Post, Archaeology in Israel as a Political Weapon. Notice the first sub-article is the one about my find in Cave 12. It says that Israel archaeology is far more than just a science. Indeed, perhaps more than any other country, the stakes of antiquities unearthed here could not be higher in terms of geopolitical implications used by warring factions to determine facts on the ground in the most contested region in the world. So the idea is that who really owns the land? Who has a right to the land? Who was here in the past? Well, archaeology could determine that. And you'll see why in a moment there's a battle between the Palestinians and Israelis over archaeological artifacts, which they claim the heritage of one over the other. The battle between right and left-wing ideologues is evident at archaeological sites in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Those are terms that are artificial and really don't apply. There is no East Jerusalem. It's not since 67. But it's still on people's maps. It's like there's no East Berlin any longer, but we don't talk about it, but they do because they don't recognize that Israel is claiming Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, East and West, united as its capital. And then when they talk about the West Bank is everything beyond this green line that was drawn that separates what is undisputed territory from disputed territory. So the disputed territory for most of the world is now termed West Bank. West Bank of what? West Bank of the Jordan. But of course that was occupied by Jordan itself. And they changed their name once they did that from Cisjordan, okay, beyond the Jordan, to or Transjordan, to Jordan. Because now they had both sides of the Jordan River, so to speak. But it's really ancient Judea and Samaria. This is the biblical term. Nothing has changed in that geography. But it says, archaeology, that is the city of David, among other things, proves beyond a doubt that thousands of years of Jewish connection to Jerusalem isn't political, it's historic. So I'm not going to give that example in my talk, but take the city of David, for instance. All the excavations that have taken place there since the, I'd say, I was there in 1979 when this started. Asked to be part of that. I was too busy being a student to be part of an archaeological dig. I regret that, but I've watched it unfold year by year. Because since 1980, there's not been a year I haven't been in Israel, every year continuously. And the interesting thing is that no artifacts have been uncovered in the city of David. They're not clearly Neolithic or Canaanite or Israelites, Hebrews. There is no strata that is Palestinian, and that's, of course, part of the political problem. The fact is, those who are threatened by such things, be they the United Nations, the Palestinians, or others, are trying to take archaeology and make it political. So as an archaeologist, I try to be apolitical, because I have to deal with all these different sides. And most archaeologists today, unfortunately, particularly in the state of Israel, are irreligious. They're not religious. They are secular. And they try to divorce the Bible from the archaeological science as much as possible. So we call them minimalists versus maximalists. The maximalist is the person that maximizes the biblical data over against the archaeological data. And the minimalist is the one who then minimizes the biblical data over against archaeological. So most of these archaeologists, their priority and their starting point is what they dig out of the ground. Of course, it's a very limited context. They don't have all the answers. They'll never get all the answers in their lifetime or many lifetimes. So if you don't have the whole picture coming from the historic document, which is itself an archaeological document, the Bible, you'll never get the picture correct. You'll never interpret things as they should be interpreted. And that's how these things go. Now, the other problem we have in the present situation is something called fake news. Okay? We've all been aware of fake news. Now, in the past, when we thought of fake news, we thought, really, of fake news. Stuff like this. All right? That's fake news. All right? Hillary Clinton adopts alien baby, or... But in the election here, 3 million aliens voted for Hillary. Did you know that one, Tom? That's the other one. Okay. All right. So that's what we thought of as fake news. But things have changed. When major networks do much of the same, may I say. So here's an interesting thing. Did you know this? Did you know that Moses led Muslims in the Exodus from Egypt? This is the claim. So you have to wonder why, well, if the Muslims came out of Egypt and then they came into the land of Canaan and they had it, then why, how did they lose it? Who did they lose it to? And if it was always their land, then, why they celebrate Passover? I don't know what they do. They don't do anything like that. Here's another example. And we're going to talk about Jerusalem now, because in Jerusalem, archaeology is politics, at least so it's said by the BBC. Because every stone has some significance. History, therefore, is translated into facts on the ground, which is translated into ownership, and then what would happen in terms of the Middle East conflict. Now, fake news becomes fake history. That's the problem. And if you've been brought up, as many Palestinians have been, for most of their school life now, hearing only one side. And you may live a stone's throw from the actual sites, but you're told completely different history, a revisionist history of things, then you wonder. And I remember one day I was in was near Damascus Gate. There was a little shop there, and I was talking to guys, and some of the Israelis were doing some kind of work further over on the Temple Mount. Not on it, but below it. And these shopkeepers were talking. They were saying, why are those guys looking for things? There's nothing there. It doesn't belong to them. You know, they're totally mystified by the fact that anybody would be digging, thinking they would find something Israeli. And this is what we hear. And this is what has happened. I'll just give you the summary historically. The political division of Islamic domination of the region in 1948, the loss of sovereignty over East Jerusalem in 1967, the hope of a Palestinian state with its capital in Jerusalem, demanded a rewriting of the facts of history to remove any basis for a Jewish claim to Jerusalem or to the site of the Muslim holy places. Any support of such claims by Islamic leaders, as requested by Israelis in peace process negotiations, is tantamount to sedition and punishable by death throughout the Islamic world. Okay, so this has all been a political shift, so the religion has followed the politics in this sense. Now, the big question we ask is, I wonder where the temple stood on the Temple Mount. And the Palestinian answer is, anywhere but here. All right. So that we read Ahmed Kurea, who was the chief Palestinian negotiator back then when the peace process was in vogue. He says, the Jewish temples never existed. Israel has been working to invent a Jewish historical connection to Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. All these attempts will fail. The Harun al-Sharif, the term for that noble enclosure, they call it, is 100% Muslim. And then we have stepping in to support such things, to make history seem to have the support of European nations and the world. UNESCO says Jews have no connection to the Temple Mount. They vote that the Temple Mount is no longer Jewish, or they write it out of Jewish history. No connection at all between that and Judaism, and they back the motions nullifying Jewish ties to the Temple Mount. And of course, it just got worse. If you can get one, you can get all. And so Hebron and the Tomb of the Patriarchs was named also, not as against the Israelis, but in favor of the Palestinian, making it a World Heritage Site. Once you do that, you exclude any other claim to that site. So what are the meaning of UNESCO's decisions regarding the Jewish heritage in the Holy Land? If you look at the cartoon, you can kind of see the idea. It's simply replacing the history and the reality of Jewish heritage in the land with the new revision of Palestinian history. So this particular article said UNESCO has unwittingly proved once and for all, I don't think it's unwittingly at all, but nevertheless, that the Mideast conflict is religious, not nationalistic in nature. And that's been known for so long. People said, why can't you sit down at a negotiating table and resolve this thing? Because it's not done through diplomacy. It's not about politics. It's not about nationalism. Okay? It's religious in nature. And there's no way you can negotiate that. It's non-negotiable on both sides. But here we know the UN also demanded that Israel abandon its capital in Jerusalem. With many such statements. We'll get to that toward the end because you can hopefully see things will be changing soon. Now, here's Palestinian revisionist history. This is the chief Palestinian justice, Sheikh Tafsir Tamimi. He's the second most important Palestinian cleric after Muhammad Hussein, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Here's what he says. Israel started since 1967, that's the pivotal date, okay, making archaeological digs to show Jewish signs to prove the relationship between Judaism and the city. And they found nothing. All these archaeological digs. I have whole shelves of books about these digs. But they found nothing. There is no Jewish connection to Israel before the Jews invaded in the 1880s. So how about this, okay? We have... It's only half the room. They should, but... Alright, so if the Jews came in the 1880s, there is no history for the Jewish people in connection with the land before the 1880s. So all of that's fabrication. All of that is lies. He says these two so-called temples, they never existed. Certainly not as the Temple Mount. All this is not real. We don't believe your versions. Your Torah was falsified. So the question we want to look at is the Islamic sacred site in East Jerusalem the site of the Jewish temple? Now let me just say, with an unqualified statement, okay, no archaeologist says that it's not. Here is Jody Magnus. I just saw her last week. She's the president of the Archaeological Institute of America, as well as professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in early Judaism. She's excavated thoroughly throughout the... She said, I know no credible scholars who question the existence of two temples or who deny they stood somewhere on the Temple Mount. It's just not even an issue. So they don't address this. From the religious point of view, someone like Chaim Richmond, who is with the Temple Institute, he says the hope for rebuilding the temple was born on the very day of its destruction 2,000 years ago. Rabbi Akiva, second century rabbi, comforted his weeping colleagues by proclaiming that if the prophecies of destruction come to pass, the fulfillment of the prophecy of redemption and rebellion is certainly to follow. I was looking at his statement. He said, in the worst of times, God said he would judge, but every prophecy of judgment is followed by a corresponding prophecy of restoration. So if this came true, that will come true. And that's the hope we all have with this. But he says, in the course of 2,000 years, the Jewish people have never forgotten the temple. The dream of rebuilding the temple spans 50 generations of Jews, 5 continents, innumerable seas and oceans. The prayer for rebuilding is recited in as many languages that are known to humanity. These prayers recited in prisons and ghettos and study halls and synagogues and homes and fields every day for 2,000 years of exile. Now gain a new dimension with the return of the people to the land of Israel. This dimension is the possibility of rebuilding the temple. So if you're going to rebuild the temple, you've got to know where the temple should be rebuilt. This is the big issue. And they claim they have no doubt of this. I wish that were, if you have, let's say, all the secular archaeologists and historians, and you have now all the Orthodox Jews, what about the evangelical Christians? Where are they in this issue? Unfortunately, not on the same page. Books have come out in the last couple of years about this, and this plays right into the revisionist history. Robert Cornuke wrote a book, and a book that is being heralded as an investigative masterpiece with astounding archaeological and prophetic implications. And they understand that if the site of the temple is that important, prophetically as well as politically, sending shockwaves through the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian worlds. Can you imagine the upheaval in political and religious thinking if the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is not the site of Solomon and Herod's temples, if the stones of the Wailing Wall are not what tradition says. This is a must-reading for everyone who wants to fit together pieces of biblical records, geopolitics, and prophecy. Now, this is not a lone book. It was built off an earlier book by Ernest Martin, who was with Hubbard W. Armstrong in the Worldwide Church of God. And he was a maverick scholar. He had good material. He just took a position that no one else had taken and hardly anyone agreed with. And some of these are following these new, also, may I say, in a sense, uncredentialed in the field they're working in. These particular writers are following that train. Here is another woman, Marilyn Sams, who writes, the Jerusalem Temple Mount myth overturned this unsubstantiated tradition that Solomon built his temple at the Dome of the Rock or anywhere else on the alleged Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And they go on to talk about this. It says, the results certify the correct interpretation of Christ's prophecy, now one stone will be left standing upon another. Which is amazing to me as an archaeologist. This is one of their positions, that God so destroyed the temple, there's not one speck of dust of it anywhere that could be found. Not any. Not a one. And when you look at, of course, Christ's prophecy, he doesn't talk about the whole of the retaining walls and all of the huge foundations. He's talking about the temple proper. And that was destroyed. And the stones, some may could be found in places, but not one was left upon another, which was the point. Not that you couldn't find them, but they wouldn't be left standing. And those were dismantled completely by the Romans and over periods of history, taken and used in secondary ways. But the retaining walls, that massive temple mount that you see, was never affected. It was never part of Jesus' prophecy. That's a misunderstanding that is made. Here's yet another one called Jerusalem's Temple Mount, the Hopes of the Millennium. Shocking as it may sound, though Jerusalem is the holy city, what is believed to be the location of the Temple Mount is nothing, though unintentionally, but a hoax. The hopes of the millennium. Okay? And they claim that this audacious contention will be proved beyond the shadow of a doubt. Well, I still have the shadow to tell you. Okay, here's another one, George Wesley Buchanan. His is a little less... It's more scholarly, but less accurate, because he doesn't deal with the archaeological material, as he should. None of them do. Here's a DVD on this. Challenges centuries of tradition when discussing the intriguing question of the exact location of the ancient temples. Or yet another one. Is this really the actual site for the temple? Could the Jews possibly be mistaken? Is there confusion concerning the site of the temple, preventing the return of Christ? So see how the prophetic ties in with these guys. The implications of this last line are monumental, not just to Israel, but to every human being on the face of the planet. Now, let me just say, okay, so what? What does this really matter? Okay, this is in-house. People can debate archaeological stuff. Well, first, truth cannot be advanced by error. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong, and this is what the Scripture says. We have to understand what the Scripture says. It's a matter of scriptural interpretation. Terms of what's there. Scripture tells us, you know, I've written you not because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it, because no lies are the truth. And then other things, the goal of our instruction is from a pure heart and a good conscience, sincere faith. All of us should want to get to the truth of these matters because they do matter, and they matter to our faith. Second, believers are responsible to critique other believers. Did you know that? There's different words in Greek for this word judge. Okay? Krino is one, means criticize, but there's other words that are proper to be used in terms of dealing with others. For instance, 1 Corinthians 5:12. What have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those within the church? We're supposed to judge one another on matters like this. Examine everything carefully, hold to what is good. If you don't examine it, and that means judging it, then you won't be able to understand the truth of it. Third, sensationalist claims adversely affect the unity of the body of Christ. And, this is a call for all of us. All of us can at times have views that tend to be on the margin. And we have to be careful that we don't press that to the point of separating fellowship or dividing the church are doing things that would affect what's there. It causes confusion among believers because believers aren't sure who to trust anymore. Skepticism toward Jewish history and tradition, because what's being said by many of these people is that this is tradition. It's just Jewish tradition. What's Jewish history? And tradition is not necessarily wrong. It's grounded in history. It's just simply history going back, maybe without all of the whistles and bells we'd like on it, but it's there. And this results in biblical truth being sidelined because you don't really try to get the truth of things. You're dealing with personalities. Sometimes you're dealing with different arguments. So it's a very careful thing. Now let me start with the issue that the Jews simply forgot about the temple. Didn't know where it was. Got lost in history. There were no Jews in the land after all, right? They all got kicked out by the Romans. Well, if you believe that, that's a myth that needs to be corrected. The Jewish people, some were sent into exile, but others stayed behind. And we know that in pivotal cities like Hebron and Jerusalem and Safed and Tiberias and many others, there were Jewish communities that remained and wrote to other Jews in the diaspora of the exile. So we know they were there. And they were left there. And they stayed there, so they never forgot what was there because they never left there. Okay, let's make that point. And that was a book, by the way, by Dan Bahat called 20 Centuries of Jewish Life in the Holy Land. In other words, there's been an unbroken succession of Jewish habitation in the land of Israel. So it wasn't left empty or barren without a witness. It's there. Now, the Jewish people never allowed themselves to forget the Holy Temple and its location on the Temple Mount. They were faithful when they swore these words from the psalmist, "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her skill. Let my tongue cleave the roof of my mouth, if I remember you not. If I don't set Jerusalem above my chief joy." With that kind of imprecatory self curse almost, would you forget where it was, that the temple was in Jerusalem? How could you ever forget that? Now, a number of scholarly papers that have come out, one by Loewenberg, investigated what the Jewish people were doing from the very beginning of the destruction in AD 70 on through. And he writes to this point. He says, "Destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 CE, that's equivalent to our AD, did not spell the end of Jewish activities on the Temple Mount. For many centuries, Jews continued their attachment to the site by maintaining a physical presence on the mountain. And when they were prevented from doing so, they prayed three times a day for speedy renewal of the sacrificial service in a restored temple. Despite the conventional wisdom that the Jewish people were banished from this holy site, the evidence suggests that Jews continued to maintain a strong connection to, even frequently, a presence on the Temple Mount for the next 2,000 years. Even when they were physically prevented from ascending the site, their attachment to Har Habayit, okay, the Mount of the Lord, remains strong and vibrant." He says, "To this we must add the fact that the entire Jewish communities continued to live in the sacred cities of Jerusalem and Hebron and Tiberias, never left the land, and they continued to speak about this throughout their history." Now, he says, "Christians seem to have forgotten the Temple Mount, as evidenced by the failure of the pilgrim Ilgera to mention on her visit to Jerusalem, and it's absent in the 6th century Matabe map." So maybe this was true of Christianity, but never of Judaism. He says, "Jews, on the other hand, never forgot the Temple Mount when none of the original temple buildings remained standing. Wherever they lived, they faced Jerusalem three times every day and prayed for the restoration of the temple and renewal of the sacrificial system. Furthermore, there are no indications, despite imperial bans, some Jews continued to pray on the Temple Mount. The late 4th century sage Rabbi Bibi offered instructions for those who went to the Temple Mount to ensure their behavior would not degrade the holiness of the place. A 6th century, a Gothic work, includes instructions for Jews everywhere to face in the direction of the Temple Mount when praying, adding that those who pray on the Temple Mount should turn to the Holy of Holies. An injunction that only makes sense if the ban is not strictly enforced." Now, if we just trace the history of this for a moment, Maimonides, in what's called Mishnah Torah, he said, "Once the site for the temple was fixed in the days of Samuel and King David, it could not be changed. So wherever it once was is where it always was, or will be. He said this sign supports the Bible's report of an official rebuilding of the temple after the Babylon exile. If you look at Ezra 5:15-16, it says, Cyrus says, take these vessels and go put them in the temple which is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its original site. And not somewhere else, because the presence of God had sanctified that site. God said, this is my place where I set my name forever. And so the Shekinah glory was intended to come back someday. It couldn't come back to a better place. It was coming back to the place from which it left. That was clear from Ezekiel's prophecies. And it says, then this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem. So he laid it right in that original site. And here is Ezra 2. It says, build this house of God, restore it on its foundation. So they had to find the original foundations and build it there. And when they restored it, they restored its ruins, okay, the very place where it was. Now, this is a summary of just the evidence from the archaeology of Jerusalem. These writers say, maintaining a sanctuary's location throughout changes of cultural and religious domination is a well-established custom in antiquity. In Jerusalem, we can physically trace this continuity on the Haramish Sharif, where the Dome of the Rock sits on top of the Temple Mount enclosure. Historical evidence suggests that Herod's temple was built in place of Zerubbabel's temple, which had been constructed soon after the return from the Babylon exile, what we were just talking about, and was meant to commemorate the exact spot of the first temple. The monumental construction of pre-Hellenistic, that is, pre-Hasmonean and pre-Herodian, extension of the eastern enclosure wall, which is what these extensions on the east and west, or north and south, you're looking at it, has been identified as the original Temple Mount platform, this 500-cubic platform that we read about in the scriptures, which was designed to level off the natural topography. That's what you see at the site itself. Now, the temple was never abandoned by Jewish believers either. You go back to the book of Acts, read statements, Luke says, very, very interesting. Jesus has now ascended to heaven, and the very next statement is, they returned after worshiping him to Jerusalem with great joy and were continuing the temple praising God. So they didn't turn their back on the temple. The temple was their gathering place, their meeting place. When you talk about Acts 22, Paul says, it happened when I returned to Jerusalem. I was praying in the temple. He didn't distance himself from the temple. Paul says he took men, purifying himself, and offered a sacrifice for each one. We have then Paul saying at the end of his life, he says, I have committed no offense against the law of the Jews or against the temple. So this is a focal point for early Jewish believers as well. And they couldn't have forgotten about it, even though many of them left before the destruction of the Second Temple, fled to the place called Pella. Their memory was still quite intent. Now, Lauenberg goes on to say, contrary to what many believe, Jews did not abandon the Temple Mount after the Temple's destruction. There's evidence that sacrifices continued on a surviving altar. It was only after the Bar Kokhba revolt, almost 50, 60 years later, the Jews were banned from the site and from Jerusalem by the victorious edict of Emperor Hadrian. And when you go to the site, you can see the destruction from AD 70. There's Rami Reich, the archaeologist who uncovered these remains. He says, the stones being revealed were remains of the Temple Mount. The temple stood in the center, of which nothing survived. And that's exactly what Jesus said would happen. But the Temple Mount and the big Herodian enclosure, this is what you see there fallen and destroyed. This is important. You can only see it here. You don't see it in any other part of Jerusalem, like the city of David, for instance. Now, in this kind of archaeological excavations, particularly ones that started after 1967, there was a structure that was found. Now, I'm showing you the picture here of what it looked like in the time of the temple. There was a stone with an inscription on it that we're told from Josephus. I'll put up Josephus' statement. He says that there was a point on the corner where it was the custom of the priests to stand and give notice by sound of trumpet in the afternoon of the approach and on the following evening of the close of every Sabbath day. So to sound the Sabbath, here's what it begins, here's what it ends. there was an inscription that said, "Stand here, blow the trumpet, announce Israel." Today they use sirens and things like that, but the same method is there. This is what it was in the time of the temple. Well, that stone was found right beneath the corner of southwestern corner of the Temple Mount, down from the Wailing Wall, the far side of the excavations going down now to the south. And here's the inscription. What I was showing you in this picture, it's been removed and taken to the museum. The piece that's missing. That's the actual stone, and then here's the inscription. It says, "To the place of trumpeting," which is the instructions for the priest. Now, here are pictures that Lee Rittmeyer sent me. This is from the day it was discovered. You can see where it was sitting right there. It was later moved just a bit. So when you go to Israel today and see it, you don't see it exactly the place where it was originally discovered. But you can see in the debris and in the remains that it had fallen right there. And to me, this is evidence. You don't need other evidence. So to say, this is mentioned by Josephus, it's connected to the temple. Here's the stone that came from the temple. Where else could it have come from? It was found there after 2,000 years, right in that location. Okay, now, we have other things found right at the corner of the Temple Mount. Here is a little pure for God seal that was used by the priest to designate objects that were to be ceremonially pure. Then we have some little gold bells that fell off of the high priest's garment, or at least one of the priest's garments. This was found inside the old city walls, just a short distance from the area of the temple, and it's described in the Bible that way. As many of you know, beginning in the late 1990s, there was destructive activity done by the Muslim Waqf. They decided to create a new mosque called Al-Mawani Mosque, and in so doing, they removed 20,000 tons of archaeologically rich debris, and they threw it into a trash dump at Al-Riza, but some ended up in the Kidron Valley, and that was recovered by Israelis. For the last 10 years, they've been having the Temple Mount Sifting Project, okay, directed by Gali Barkan. In that, these were found, and I'll show you just getting ahead of myself. I and my team, working there for 3 weeks, we found these. What are these? These are the very shells that were used to dye the priestly tefillin, the garments used by the priests themselves. We know exactly where this came from. It came right from that section of the Temple Mount. If that was a Roman fort or something else, why would you have these particular things related to Jewish halakha, Jewish life there? Recently, too, in the Temple Mount Sifting Project, they found these stones, quite a few of them. This is just a small sampling of them. And there are these marble decorated stones. According to Josephus, again, it tells us that the courtyard of the temple was lined with stones of different colors. Talmud also said that they were colored marble. And this came from the Temple Mount. It simply is part of the flooring of one of the courts of the temple. Where else could it have come from? Just let me remind you historically, the Temple Mount was turned by Byzantine Christians into a city dump. If you look at this kind of reconstruction, you see the Temple Mount that is desolate now, and there are two main roads, the eastern and western cardo there. The eastern cardo is the one closest to the Temple Mount, and it was actually put there, and then they brought the garbage from the gate outside of this, on the far end. This is Damascus Gate, and this came from down here with the garbage and dumped it on the Temple Mount as sort of a statement that God rejected the Jews, God rejected all of their worship system, and so the trash and stuff was dumped there, and that's why you call that the Dung Gate today, where you enter. And this was done at the instigation of Constantine. He wrote to Eusebius this: "Let us have nothing in common with that detestable Jewish crowd, for we have received from our Savior a different way." And Helena, his mother, said the Byzantines wanted to turn the site of the temple into a trash dump in order to fulfill the words of the New Testament. Okay? And which is, you know, more plausible? Helena, the mother of a Roman emperor, would have turned the site of a former Jewish temple into a city dump, or that she had done that to the site of a former Roman fortress, because this is what the other people are saying, this was a Roman fortress up here. Well, it's very unlikely. Now, This is the desolate Temple Mount, Eastern Cardo. I was part with my wife Beverly excavating this, and this is the Eastern Cardo. You can see now from this perspective, the temple represented the place of the temple by the Dome of the Rock, the Eastern Cardo here, and the street that was uncovered. So here's the area itself, which you're just looking at on the map. And you can find the Hadrianic Street that we helped uncover. Now, 3,000 years of graves, Jewish graves, on the Mount of Olives facing the Temple Mount also argue for this being a sacred site to the Jewish people. They wouldn't have put them where they put them if there wasn't some significance across the valley. And we know after Hadrian banned Jews from entering Jerusalem, they were able to come at least once a year to the Mount of Olives and on Tisha B'Av, the commemoration of the destruction of the temple, and there lament that destruction from that place. You can't get to the city of David from there. It's way down in the valley the other way. This is the place where we know historically they went. Now, also, if we move forward in history a little bit, to the 4th century, just below Robinson's Arch, there's a stone. And it's hard to see today because the ground level has been made much lower. But if you look at the inscription, it was made by some Jewish person returning to Jerusalem thinking that the Julian the Apostate was going to rebuild the temple for the Jewish people. He denounced that, and he wanted to do that, and people were coming back thinking that was going to happen, and a new era would occur. So he writes these words from Isaiah 66:14. When you see these things, your heart will rejoice, and your bones will flourish like the grass. A picture of the restoration promise to the Jewish people. Well, of course, that didn't happen. But it is testimony to someone. He wrote those on the walls of what he considered the Temple Mount there in the 4th century. Okay? Just a few years ago, down in the Ophel, just below the steps of the area that entered into the temple, on that southern end, it was discovery of this medallion. Now, it's not a medallion as such. It was actually part of a scroll, Torah scroll cover. But it was, because of the coins and things they found, a big cache of gold coins, they determined this was right on the eve of the Muslim invasion. And the Jews had been there and were attempting to they had established Jewish practice and services there, wanted to build some things there, but of course the Muslim invasion ended that. And that's where that was buried. But it was there, not somewhere else. We come to the time just of the Muslim invasion. This is written by historian Eusebius in 8660 from the Armenian History. He says, I'll relate a little more about the intentions of the rebellious Jews. Having earlier received help from the leaders of the children of Hagar, okay, he means the Arabs here, conceived a plan to rebuild the Temple of Solomon. Having discovered the place, which is called the Holy of Holies, they built on its foundations a prayer place for themselves. However, the Ishmaelites, and we know who these Muslims now in this case, jealous of them, drove them from this place and called it their house of prayer. So wherever they say the Jews built this, that's what the Muslims now call their house of prayer, which would be where the Dome of the Rock would be today. So it's simply saying in this early history, they identified the Dome of the Rock with the site of Solomon's Temple. We can do the same thing and look at the construction of the Dome of the Rock in 691. Caliph Omar was led by the Christian priest Sophronius in AD 538. He knew where this stone that was the foundation stone within the temple was beneath the garbage and took him there. And Gershon Solomon wrote this. He was a professor of Oriental Studies at Hebrew University. This was this area, Islamic studies. This is Caliph Abdelmelek, the one who succeeded Caliph Omar and built the Dome of the Rock, even anointed 10 Jewish families and gave them responsibilities of guardianship of the Holy Temple Mount in the name of the Jewish people. Till today, the Muslims call the Holy Temple Mount Bayt al-Maqdis, which is Arabic for the exact Jewish name of the Holy Temple, which in Hebrew is Beit HaMikdash, okay? The Holy House, something like this. And these facts alone could serve to confirm that the Holy Temple Mount was the real location of the first and second temples. But now look at this. This just came up this last year, and a place called Nuba This is in the Palestinian area. It's the Nuba Mosque. And some Israelis were in there, and they noticed this inscription in the mosque, which is an active mosque. Here's the inscription. It says, "In the name of Allah, the merciful God, this territory, Nuba, and all its boundaries and its entire area is an endowment to the rock of Bayt al-Mikdash and the Al-Aqsa Mosque." So they know what the Al-Aqsa Mosque is. But this, what is the other? Well, it's obviously the Dome of the Rock. But what are they calling it? They're calling it by the name of the temple. All right? And so this confirms, at least Islamic sources, that this was that site. I won't go into some of the details here. People have talked about it. Here's a statement from an 8th century Islamic work. "The rock that is in Bayt al-Maqdis is the center of the entire universe." But you know from Islamic tradition that Muhammad ascended from that rock, but there was no sacrifice by Abraham, Ishmael there. That was done in Mecca, not in Jerusalem. So it's, why is it the center of the universe? Well, but why is it called the temple? Here is a scholar that says, look, this is an Egyptian scholar. He says, "The Al-Aqsa Mosque, in my view, is not the one in Jerusalem. It cannot be." He goes on to say, "Al-Aqsa is not ours." Al-Aqsa means the farthest mosque. "It does not refer to the far mosque on the Temple Mount, but rather to the mosque that is further of the two mosques in Mecca, that is Medina. The only reason why Muslims insist on the sanctity of Jerusalem is simply politics." Okay, get that straight. And to confirm that, here is the president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. He made this statement. If you went back a couple of hundred years before the advent of political form of Zionism, I think you would find that many Muslims would not have disputed the connection that Jews had toward the Temple Mount. The problem began arising with the advent of Zionism. People started connecting a kind of feeling that the Jews had toward the area with the political project of Zionism. See what he's saying? And he was threatened with the loss of his job for having said that. He was forced to retract it, but it was still printed. Then we have a statement, and I own one of these copies. Every copy from the 1930s to the 1950s, this is a guidebook published by the Haram al-Sharif, or on the Haram al-Sharif, the guidebook to the Temple Mount, published in English by the Supreme Muslim Council. Right? And this is what it says on the first page. "This site is one of the oldest in the world. Sanctity dates from the earliest times. Its identity with the Temple of Solomon is beyond dispute." Yeah, these are the same people that deny the Temple Mount exists today. Now, I want to play a little clip, because I want you to know the whole Arab world is not necessarily united on these things. If we're going to straighten the revisionist history out, we have to have some people in the Arab world that know the facts. So I want to play a little clip for you. You may not have seen this. It just came out on November 19th. And it's quite interesting. So let's see. Let me get started here. Now, you're going to read the subtitles, because it's all in Arabic. So read the subtitles that are there, and you'll get the idea.
من هي إسرائيل؟ شنو تمثل إسرائيل؟ هل هو هي دولة؟ هل هو جماعة منظمة إرهابية؟ كيان؟ كيف ممكن أن نفسرها؟
Do I need to read it further about you? You see it all right?
دولة إسرائيل شئنا ما بينها هي دولة مستقلة ذات سيادة لها وجود ولها مقعد في الأمم المتحدة وأكثر الدول المحبة للسلام والديمقراطية تعترف بها بقي مجموعة من الدول لا تعترف بها وهي دول الاستبداد والقمت مثلا على ذلك كوريا الشمالية لا تعترف بإسرائيل ولكن هذا لا يغير الدولة وأنها موجودة شئنا أم أبينا دولة إسرائيل تملك من المراكز العلمية والجامعات ما لا تملكه أعتى الدول العربية وأقدم الدول العربية فدولة إسرائيل هي دولة وليست منظمة إرهابية هي دولة كما قلت مستقلة
وشرعية
نعم أخذت شرعيتها من مكانتها في الأمم المتحدة أما ما تفضل به أبو سيف من أن هذا كيان غاصب فهذا مردود عليه دينيا وسياسيا دينيا الآية رقم 21 من سورة المائدة تثبت أن بني إسرائيل لهم الحق في الأرض المقدسة. قال الله تعالى: وإذ قال موسى لقومه يا قوم ادخلوا الأرض المقدسة التي كتب الله لكم. إذن الله كتبها لهم ولم يكونوا كيانا غاصبا لها. الكيان الغاصب هو من كان فيها قبل أن يدخلها بني إسرائيل. وبالتالي أنا لا أميل إلى الشعارات والعبارات والمفردات التي عفى عليها الزمن مثل كيان غاصب وصهيوني ولا ينفي أنني عربي اعترافي بإسرائيل أبدا. أنا أعترف بإسرائيل أنها دولة وحقيقة واقعة، ولكن لا أنكر عروبتي ولا أنكر انتمائي للدول العربية. أنا ما أعرف، يعني شوف أنا حجب إطار الموضوع القضية الفلسطينية عموما واحتلال فلسطين، هل هو قضية عربية ولا قضية دينية؟
ليس هناك احتلال، ليس هناك احتلال، هناك شعب عاد إلى أرضه الموعودة. هل تعرف تاريخ بني إسرائيل؟ ضارب في القدم تاريخ بني إسرائيل قبل الإسلام، وبالتالي يجب أن نعترف ونحن مسلمين أن بني إسرائيل لهم الحق في هذه الأرض ولم يغتصبوها. الذي يقول أنها مغتصبة هم الذين ما زالوا يفكرون بعقلية 1950 وما قبل ذلك.
جميل جداً.
وفي عام 1948 عندما أنشأت دولة إسرائيل لم يكن هناك وجود لدولة اسمها فلسطين.
يعني وين حين هذا الاسم والذي عندنا فعلنا فيه فلسطين؟
لا، هذا
ما لا ما يكون.
ليس له وجود، ليس له وجود أبداً. هم عبارة عن شتات يتشكك في بعض الدول العربية، وكانوا يسمون الكنعانيين أو العماليق أو لها أسماء متعددة جدا، حتى أن الآية الكريمة قالت إن فيها قوما جبارين، كان من يسميهم الجبارين. وبالتالي لا وجود لدولة اسمها فلسطين، وأصر أنا على
ذلك. خلك مقالة مبادر ذكرت فيها حرفيا يا ليتني كنت جنديا إسرائيليا.
نعم.
يعني هل وصل أنا هو موضوع اعتراف فقط. أنت اليوم تتمنى أن تكون جندي في وما تربطها بلسانك، تربطها كشباب عربي. يعني تربطها بأن الشباب العربي يتمنى أن يكون جنود لإسرائيل. هل هذا منطقي وواقعي؟
هذا المقال كتب عام 2006 عندما خطف الجندي الإسرائيلي جلعاد شاليت. وأمنيتي أن أكون جنديا إسرائيليا ليس المقصود بها أن أحمل السلاح وأحارب مع إسرائيل. الأمنية هي أن الدولة هي دولة إسرائيل كيف انتفضت عن بكرة أبيها لتدافع عن جندي واحد إسرائيلي. فأنا أقول يا ليتني كنت جنديا حتى تدافع عني دولتي. بالله عليك لو كان هذا الجندي في دولة عربية دون أن أسمي دولة،
المقال موجود،
دون أن أسمي دولة معينة، هل كانت أمته أو كانت دولته أو كان رئيس دولته حينتفض نفس الانتفاضة الذي انتفضته إسرائيل؟ آلاف القتلى من الدول العربية ولا أحد يهتم بهم.
450,000 في سوريا alone.
وأرجو أن نسميها التعايش السلمي مع دولة إسرائيل.
وهذا اللي ما عملوا به مصر والأردن.
بالضبط. هو تعايش سلمي.
شنو كان نتيجته؟
استفادة الطرفين.
فهل نحن اليوم كعرب وكمسلمين يجب أن نقف مع الإسرائيليين وحزبهم؟
هناك مقولة لدولة أو لرئيس دولة خليجية كبرى تقول لدي استعداد أن أتحالف مع الشيطان ضد الكيان الفارسي. والشيطان هنا يقصد بإسرائيل، لأن هم يسمون إسرائيل الشيطان. ولكن أنا أقول لماذا لا أتعايش سلميا مع إسرائيل وأتعاون معها على رد عدوي الكبير اللي هو النظام الفارسي؟
والكيان الصهيوني
النظام الفارسي يتباهى بأنه احتل 4 عواصم عربية وسيحتل الخامسة. هل قالت إسرائيل هذا الكلام أو تباهت بأنها احتلت شيء؟ لم تتباهى لأنها لم تحتل، هي جاءت إلى بلدها. أما الكيان الفارسي الإيراني فهو كيان مغتصب. أنا أؤيد أن يكون هناك تحالف ثلاثي بين إسرائيل والدول الخليجية العربية وأمريكا لمحو شيء اسمه حزب الله من الوجود، محو كامل، لا تقوم له قائمة أبدا.
Let's just let you know there are those who know the truth out there. This is a Kuwaiti writer, by the way, All right, so you can get the guy, well, and you saw the reactions of everybody else. They were just kind of didn't know what to do about that. All right, so let me pass this. This is the man, Kuwaiti Muslim scholar and writer, Abdullah Al-Hadlak. Okay, so you can find this easily on YouTube, not a problem. Okay. Just to highlight some of those differences between the Muslim world again, I always like this. More women fly F-16s in Israel than drive cars in Saudi Arabia. Just help us remember that, okay? Now, let me move, if I may, and I hope everybody's still hanging with me here. We're going to move to the area of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is a danger area in archaeology right now. There is a group called Emek Shaveh, which is pro-Palestinian, and they very much against Israeli archaeology anywhere that would prove facts on the ground. They say the West Bank, occupied by Israel in 1967, is considered by many Israelis to be the cradle of the nation, the place where the stories of the Bible actually took place. Israel began conducting archaeological surveys and excavations immediately after 1967. The Israeli preoccupation with the past, real or imaginary, has a decisive impact on the discourse within Israel, on everyday reality of those who live in the West Bank, and on the political conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. So here's how this plays out in my own personal drama. The Palestinians, this last year, made a play for the Dead Sea Scrolls at UNESCO, claiming that they are theirs. Why is it theirs? They're written in Hebrew. Okay? Why is it theirs? Okay, were the Palestinians 2,000 years ago, right, in Hebrew, observing Jewish customs? No, this is very strange. No, it's in land that they say belongs to them, so everything from that land, through time immemorial, belongs to them as well. Now, unfortunately, they have support from Europe. You may not have seen this, but our German contingents here can cringe a little bit. Germany has said the Dead Sea Scrolls don't belong to Israel. They wanted to have a major exhibition of the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel, in Frankfurt, and they said, fine, you can send the Dead Sea Scrolls here. We're not going to send them back. Now, who's going to, I mean, a Dead Sea Scroll, a piece the size of your thumbnail, is worth $1 million. So there's an estimable value. Here's what was said in this article. But as Qumran, the site of the scroll's original discovery, lies about a mile northwest of the Dead Sea in the Judean desert, the German government refuses to guarantee or dismiss any future claims by Palestinian or Jordanian activists that the scrolls are Palestinian or Jordanian property. Okay, Palestinian activists argue that the scrolls were discovered in the West Bank. They are Palestinian property. Even as they are clearly an historical relic of ancient Jewish sect, and even if the scrolls were originally discovered in 1946, when Qumran, like the rest of mandatory Palestine, was under British control. Boris Rhein, the culture minister from the German state of Hesse, told the German press last week that Germany's foreign minister and federal commissioner for cultural affairs believe that the ownership of the Dead Sea Scrolls is unclear. And if Germany is unwilling to clearly express the legal status of the fragments of Qumran as Israel, as Israeli world cultural heritage goods, he said it would drastically change the coordinates in German-Israeli relations. Okay? It means that much to the Israelis. Now, in 2013, I was finishing some of my work at Qumran. I was 10 years director of excavations at this site. And in the last year, a young man from Berkeley came, and he wanted to interview me, and I should have been a little more wary. I was aware his politics were where mine were, but I thought, well, I could straighten him out, and maybe a little arrogant of me. Later, this was published in the Atlantic Monthly, and the title was Biblical Pseudo-Archaeologist Pillages the West Bank. And notice it says here, for Randall Price, a mid-50s, I was in my 60s then, son Redden Pastor from Texas, I wasn't a pastor at that time, and I was living in Virginia, teaching at Liberty University, okay, a neat side part in a booming voice, archaeology is both a scientific and devotional endeavor. It's like, there you make it something spiritual, right? prices his own work underwrites Israeli precedence in some Palestinian land. This, and here's my quote. Despite the fact that Qumran is probably on the map of the Palestinians, which it is, the fact is we're unearthing ancient Jewish heritage. There's nothing here that speaks to any other people. Flat out. There isn't. Okay? So, you know, I've found a few Roman remains, maybe, but that's it. Nothing. All right. And so our discovery, this is Fox's opinion. There are some other papers that put this out when we made our discovery. Said, why an incredible new discovery proves the Dead Sea Scrolls belong to Israel. And that's the discovery we made this last January. And so I wanted to show that to you so you could kind of understand where I have been with my team, where we're going to go in just about two, three weeks back to do it again. So this is called Operation Scrolls. The first time in 60 years that a Dead Sea Scroll cave has been discovered and excavated. And where these caves are, if you look at the map of Israel, you can see Qumran in this northwestern corner of the Dead Sea, about 19 miles to the south of Jerusalem. And there's a string of caves running north and south all the way down past Masada in the south, and just always past Qumran, a little further up to a place called Akini and others to the north. But at Qumran itself, there was a community of Jews. We believe they were very Orthodox Jews, probably more Orthodox than the ones in Jerusalem, who were Hasmonean, who were non-Zadokite priests, who really weren't legitimate priests for the temple, who had cooperated with the political situation, allowed a lot of things that weren't right. And when you see this on the pages of the New Testament, you see the Sadducees and others, and the scribes, being condemned for this kind of laxical behavior and not to really understand what God wants. So these guys separated themselves and started a community down in the desert because they saw Isaiah chapter 40, verse 1, and following, it was a voice crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. So they felt Messiah was coming. They were reading the Messianic scriptures. They said, Messiah is coming. And they were right. They started their community about 200 years before the birth of Jesus with the idea that he's coming, or someone's coming. And so this is where they remained. In the process, they brought copies of the Bible with them to study, and the oldest we know of is about 300 B.C. The great Isaiah scroll that was discovered, the longest of the Dead Sea Scrolls, is from 125 B.C. So what they were doing is these things were used, they would wear out, and they would recopy them, and they would take the old scrolls, and they would put them away. And they did this on a biblical precedent, because in Jeremiah 32 it says, this is one of our restoration promises. Jeremiah knew that the Jews were going into exile, and God said, look, buy a piece of land, take the deed, put it in an earthenware jar, seal it up that it may last for a long time. So when you come back from the exile someday, the land will still have this pledge of promise. It's there. So they followed that idea, and they took their scrolls, the oldest copies we know of the Bible, commentaries on the Bible, other kind of sectarian writings that they made, and they put them in these jars and they put them in caves. And then the Romans came in the year AD 68, burned and destroyed their community. Many of them fled down to Masada, others up to, probably toward Jerusalem. Many were killed. But the secret of where they buried these things was lost until the 1940s. Some of you know that history. I won't recount it. But since 1956, no Dead Sea Scroll cave had been found. So this was our discovery 60 years later to do this. This is the cave we found based on a survey done in the 1990s. This was also political. 1993, the Declaration of Principles was signed between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, with Bill Clinton in the middle, you know, trying to make peace. And it was to set our course on the Oslo peace process. And the idea was that we would trade land for peace. This is why Jericho went back to, didn't go back to the Palestinians, that's the language they used, but it was given to the Palestinians. And so the feeling was that Qumran was on that same map, and it was. It wasn't talked about, but the archaeologist got nervous. He said, if this goes back to the Palestinians, then all of the local Bedouin who just loot these caves to sell it to the highest bidder on the black market and are Palestinian will have free reign. and there won't be any protection for the Jewish heritage that's here. So they took about 200 archaeologists, they combed the desert, and as many caves as they could, they surveyed and they put numbers on them, and they said, they published this. So I took that published list and did some of my own study, and basically found this cave, which I thought was a good candidate. It was labeled K53. And so a lot of work to be done to excavate something like this. My son John, who's here, he was our dig administrator, ran all the construction, because you have to build the area to stand on if you can fall off the edge of a cliff. But here's what the cave looked like before excavation. And this is the tunnel that was in the cave. It was about a 50-foot long tunnel that was stretched in the back of the cave. But you can see all these heavy rocks. That's the result of 2,000 and more years of earthquake activity. These are limestone fault caves, so when earthquakes come, these rocks that are there just simply chip off and break off and fall on the ground. So we had at least a foot or two of solid rock covering everything. Now I'll show you what the excavation is like. No one could get in that tunnel except one little skinny girl from Liberty University. So this is what it was like. Then we have sound here. That's what the process looked like. I'll get some more of this. Bucket by bucket, soy by soy, as the stones come out, it makes room for others to get in. And one of those was me.
And along these niches, you see we have scroll jars, perhaps scroll jars, but certainly jars that were used for depositing things. When these jars were put in, there's one here, and there's another one over here. We found these here. There were rocks blocking this, which means they were sealed intentionally, or trying to hide these things. We have these large parts of the scroll jar, a base over here, a rim like here. All right, all things which are typical of the kind of jars and other caves at Qumran.
So what was going on here was that we had niches that had been cut in the sides of these caves. And you couldn't see them because they were covered with rocks. So anybody going in the past just missed it. But in those niches were placed the jars. Now they were crushed because of the earthquake activity, and they were also empty because before the Jews had left the area, they took the scrolls with them. But not the heavy jars. They left those behind. It's like a library where you carry the heavy jars there, you put them in place, then you put the scrolls in, you take the scrolls out, check in, check out, you know, and this kind of thing. But we found remains of this. So you can see some of the activity. Here's these jars. And when they're assembled, they'll be entire jars, whole jars. Down in the lower part of the cave, we had a similar situation. You can see the niches, how they were cut, and the jars were there. Here's one of the jars coming out like this. And that's a pretty big jar. It's about this big around. Lots of large pieces of pottery coming out. One of the guys working with us, you may recognize, he's the CEO of the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C., Harry Summers. So I'll let him speak for himself here.
Okay. Hey, we're in Qumran, or outside of Qumran, and we're in a new excavation cave. Quite exciting. A lot of reasons why there hasn't been a lot of excavations the last several years. A lot of it has to do with the geopolitical issues in this area. But since things have changed a little bit, there's a new effort to explore many of the caves that people have known about, but they don't know what's in. And we're really in a very exciting one today. This is a live excavation that's going on. And I'm going to show you, I'm going to just put the flashlight on some pottery. You can see this is a jar, a storage jar of some kind. And storage jars are what the scrolls were found in. Some of them were found in the various caves in Qumran. And we're right next to what's considered Qumran. But this is just a small sampling of what's in this cave. There are many other areas that have even more than this. And then I'm going to take my flashlight. We're going to turn over here. We're going to look down a tunnel. And this tunnel leads to even more. And you can see that this tunnel opens up into a much larger area. So far, this cave has yielded some fascinating material that is being reviewed right now. We're here on Friday, January the 20th. It's being analyzed on Friday, January the 20th, as quickly as possible because of the potential significance of it. And this is excavations being headed up by Dr. Randall Price from Liberty, and we've known Randall for many years. And he's really one of the key experts dealing with excavations, dealing primarily with the Dead Sea Scroll, but Qumran more than the scrolls themselves. And this is looking good. They're going to be digging all day today and some next week, and they'll then determine how much more they'll want to do. And as Museum of the Bible, we think this is important. This is really one of the things we stand for is looking for evidence that proves the Bible even more so, certainly enlightens us more about the Bible, about how it came about, how ancient writings came about, the cultural setting of the day came about. Really exciting stuff. And this is what we talk about. This is what we talk about, why we're involved with the Tel Shamron excavation that will be starting just a little later in the spring, dealing with 22 layers of civilization, and why we're involved with this excavation, because it is critical. And we live in a skeptical world. And the more evidence that's found, it's simply one scoop of dirt at a time in Israel, adds to more information and a better understanding of how ancient writings came about and who were these people that we're putting a lot of faith into them, because a lot of our most of our translations come from these ancient manuscripts. And if indeed there are manuscripts found here, we'll see. But indeed, even with the pottery, it's showing confirmation of people being in this area. It's known as the Dead Sea Scroll area. And here we go again. So, you know, we've always said we always wonder why God has held certain things open, why certain things have not been discovered, why certain things are now being discovered. And we don't know the answer to that, but we can say this. There's as many, if not more, discoveries going on today than in the last 20, 30 years. Absolutely amazing. And why now? We don't know. But God indeed is up to something, and we really, really believe that. And this is the evidence today. So you get to see what we're doing, and they're pushing us out of the way so they can climb through this next tunnel that we just pointed out. So we'll give you a little more footage here in just a little while. Thanks.
We'll play the next clip is with some of the experts who are involved with this. One wrote a book called The Caves of Qumran, and he explains why this is really what it is.
This is a new chapter in the history of the excavation of the Cave of Qumran. Here we find again all the pattern of the manuscript cave. So actually, even if you don't find the manuscript nowadays, we have to think that some manuscripts were here at some time.
And then the climactic statement is made by Penina Shore, who is head at the Israel Museum.
So I would say this is extremely exciting, because I think it's the first, for me at least, it's the first time ever that we really see a jar in situ.
In the place where it's found.
Since, as Owen says, it's a sealed cave, meaning there was no interruption between Second Temple times, Roman period, and your entrance. Therefore, this is what every archaeologist who has the scroll syndrome dreams of. Okay, to come across a sealed layer, cave, whatever, with the jars, and now all you need to do is find the scrolls, and if you want to even do it better, find the textile that wrapped the scrolls. And then that's the discovery of the first most important discovery of the 21st century, as far as we're concerned.
So she said, you got to find the scrolls. Well, it wasn't long until we were digging, came out of one of the jars, this little piece of rolled up leather, and that we know is part of a scroll. And we found after that pieces of papyrus, which are also parts of scrolls, other folded up pieces of papyrus. And then we found the linen wrappings that they came from, the very expensive textiles garments that they used in a secondary way to wrap up the scrolls themselves. And so we found this, and we found the strings that tied the scrolls, other pieces like this, fabric and things that were throughout that area. So we can say we found the scroll cave, no question about that. But at the end, the very last day of excavation last year, something else happened. And I'll play this for you.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Look at this. Oh, my gosh. Oh. Look at this. Hmm. Oh, my gosh. There's another one.
So he's digging with these iron picks, but he's finding iron picks. What's going on here?
Oh, look at this. Looks like somebody's been here before. Okay, we need to show this to Randy.
Well, what was found were two iron picks. And when they were dated, it was found they came from the Second Temple period. That is the time of Jesus. So these original picks that were used to actually cut those niches to put the scroll jars in which they put the scrolls. And nothing like that had been found before. So all I'm saying is we've started down a road which we hope is going to have some good repercussions for the state of Israel. And here's Israel Hassan, who is the Director General of the Israel Antiquities Authority. He said this about the discovery. The important discovery of another scroll cave attests to the fact that a lot of work remains to be done in the Judean desert, and finds of huge importance are still waiting to be discovered. We're in a race against time, as antiquity thieves steal heritage assets worldwide for financial gain. We need to mobilize and allocate the necessary resources in order to launch an historic operation together with the public to carry out a systematic excavation of all the caves of the Judean desert. And this is important because the scrolls, we still don't know a lot about how the history of the Bible came about, transmission of the text. The more texts we have, the better that information will be for us. We'll also find how they interpreted the Bible, because many of these things could be their own interpretations, and we already know they're a very messianic community. So what's nice about this is it fits right hand in glove with what we read in the New Testament. When you realize that the scribes and the Pharisees and Sadducees left no writings. Read about them in the New Testament, Plato, Josephus, but they left us nothing. The only other information we have from that time period is what we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So this is the pivotal point, the time when Jesus comes, when the early church is formed. We have nothing. This is the context itself. So this stuff is extremely valuable, both for Old Testament, New Testament studies, I think for Messianic studies as well. Now, one of the bloggers at Logos put this. They said, the New Dead Sea Scroll Cave is arguably the most important find in biblical archaeology of the last 60 years. Discovery is significant because, although no new manuscripts are found, reignites the efforts to find additional sealed caves and they contain untouched manuscripts, both biblical and sectarian. And so this is the thing we're doing. Our excavations will continue. I'll be going back here. My son-in-law and I are working down in one cave. We'll go back in a few weeks for the entire month of January to excavate more. And I'll show you this cave 53 where we were. And then an adjacent cave just above it, which has been undocumented. It wasn't in the original survey. And my belief is that just as in the north, you had clusters of caves, caves 1 and 2 and 3, and then it jumps to, 11 that were there. And then at Qumran itself, there were, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. These caves tend to be clustered together. So we find one in the south, there must be others nearby. So this is the next cave we're going to excavate. And then up above it is cave 52. Explored but not excavated. And this has an even longer tunnel in it, and there's pieces of pottery that can be found, and these are the kind of pieces of store jars, so we know there must be stuff in there. And so this is what we're going to do. What's very interesting, and this is what contributes to the understanding of the politics and how it affects things, Israel's museums have that influence on tourists coming over. This is Jewish history. This is Jewish heritage. This establishes the facts on the ground that Israel was here in the ancient days and no one else. And this is their land and remains their land. And what the Shrine of the Book has now told us is they're building a new wing that's going to house our material. The stuff that we're finding is going straight from the caves to the lab and then into the museum to help educate and, again, promote the understanding of this being part of Jewish history. Now, I just want to wind up with something. We're going to talk some more about current events tonight. And the issue is, as we talk about these things, why don't people get it? Why are there so diverse views? Why we have these facts, we have revisionist history, everything else. What's the real problem in the Middle East conflict? There's an old story that you may have heard. It talks about it like this. It says, one day on the banks of the Nile, an alligator was sunning himself, and out of the desert came a scorpion. And the scorpion came up to the crocodile and said, friend, crocodile, or alligator, whatever you want, let me ride on your back across the water. I've got to get across the Nile. We'll be at peace. Come on, let's do this. He said, nothing doing. Why should I do that? You'll sting me and I'll die. But the scorpion said, no. If I stung you and I'm on your back, we'll both die. He thought about that. He said, that makes sense. Okay, let's go. So they started off across the Nile. No sooner did they get almost to the midpoint of the Nile, the scorpion got agitated, stung the crocodile. They both started to sink beneath the water. And the crocodile says, what possible reason could you have for doing this? And the scorpion replied, there is none. This is the Middle East. This is a Middle East joke. And they think it's very funny. But it simply says, there is no reason why people do this, okay? They're killing themselves, but they do it. One thing, though, we see in the fulfillment of things that current events are leading to is the fulfillment of the promise of the fathers. Romans 15:8, Messiah says, I say that Messiah has become a servant through the circumcision, the Jewish people, on behalf of the truth of God to confirm the promise given to the fathers. And it was present tense then, and it's present tense now. It hasn't changed. It's still the same promise, and it's going to be fulfilled. And that's why Messiah is coming. So that leads us to one of our current events. Our U.S. president saying that tomorrow he'll declare that Jerusalem will finally be recognized as the United Capital of Israel. Okay? Because if the promise concerns Jerusalem and Messiah's return to Jerusalem, you're going to have a Jerusalem. It's not something else. And so this is moving that direction. So we know it's going to be controversial and it's going to lead to all kind of things, but it's a courageous stand, and it's also one of his promises that he's fulfilling. Let me just conclude with this. The things that we see with current events are part of what God intended. We've seen the past events, and archaeology is part of that past. We've seen how splendidly it's been fulfilled in very meticulous and key ways. And if that's happened exactly as it should have happened, then what can we expect for the future? And Peter says it. We have the prophetic word now made more sure by the fulfillment of those past promises, to which you do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place. And it's a dark place today, getting darker all the time, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in hearts. And this is that promise of the Messiah to come, first to rapture his church, of course, and then ultimately to come back to this earth. And that's what stands before us always in all of our discussion of current events. The prophetic word made more sure. Let me just say, if some of you want some more information on this, I have a new book, a handbook of biblical archaeology, just published by Zondervan 2 weeks ago. We had some here. They're sold out, unfortunately, already. But our website, worldofthebible.com, can accommodate you with an order if you'd like to place that. You can go to Amazon and other places as well. But it's a full-color book, and it has some of the things you saw about the cave excavation that we did. Well, Tommy, that's all I've got for the moment, so I'll turn this back to you.
Okay. You need to hook Randy up again. Where is he? Randy, you need to be hooked up again. Okay, we're going to get started again. And what we want you to do tonight is, by the way, I forgot to do that this year, the Tuesday evening current events thing started our second year when Hal Lindsey spoke here on a Tuesday night. And he gave his talk, and then everybody started asking him questions about current events. And so we have made Tuesday night about current events ever since. And that was in 1993 when that happened. So we've been doing it since 1993. And it just so happened both of our current events guys weren't able to come that we had scheduled. Soren Kern moved to Spain 3 weeks ago, but he said he would most likely be available for next year. And he is a pretty amazing guy. And, you know, he has a master's degree in Georgetown Political Science. And he works with, who's that guy on Fox all the time? John Bolton. He works with John Bolton at the Gatestone Institute. And he actually advises Donald Trump on terrorism to some degree as well. But he's not here. He's in Spain right now. And he was an advisor to the Spanish government for 19 years on terrorism and that kind of stuff. And he's been here a number of years. And, of course, Bill Koenig, I remember, I guess it was about 15 years ago when we were doing our current events thing, and he showed up from nowhere. And I was standing in the back of the room at the door when it was going on, and he started telling me stuff. So I said, hey, why don't you go down there and grab a mic? And that's how he started. So we've had him pretty much every year because he's a White House correspondent, and he knows what's going on there. And Koenig. What is it, Koenig.org or Watch.org? Yeah, Watch.org is his website and things. So we're going to start with question answers again right now. And there's been a lot of, even while Randy was talking, I got like three or four pushes from Jerusalem Post, Fox News, saying that Donald Trump is going to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital tomorrow. He's not going to move the embassy yet, but he is apparently going to give detailed plans on moving the embassy. So he has to sign off or move the embassy tomorrow. So he's going to say we're going to do it to declare Jerusalem, recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And this whole idea of not recognizing Jerusalem goes back to the United Nations, where they wanted to make it into an international city. You know, going back all the way to San Remo after World War I, where it was supposed to be an international city. And then after 10 years, the people in Jerusalem were going to vote whether they wanted to be Arab or Jewish. And Jerusalem, for the last 150 years, has had a predominant Jewish population. And if they had done that, so they didn't do it in 47 when everything went south, when they voted to partition the land of, they call it Palestine, but you know what we're referring to, the land of Israel. And the war broke out and all this stuff. But the internationals want to have Jerusalem as an international city, supposedly. But the way I read Bible prophecy is the Jews are going to be in control of Jerusalem during the tribulation. Is that what y'all read? Yeah. Otherwise, how would they have a rebuilt temple and the two witnesses and all this kind of stuff? Yes. And, yeah. And John Whitcomb speculated in his commentary years ago that it could be that the two witnesses oversee in some way the rebuilding of the temple and protect the nation of Israel during that time, because they have the power to call down fire from heaven if anybody messes with them, you know. And then, of course, they're killed in the middle of tribulation, etc. So we expect Jerusalem to be under Jewish control. And so Donald Trump, like Harry, and people have already compared him to Harry Truman at this point, you know, of doing something. His own State Department is totally fighting him on this. You know, all the leftists at Foggy Bottom. Harry Truman used to gripe about them, you know, the Foggy Bottom boys or something like that. And Truman, you know, when he recognized Israel, nobody in his administration, which were mainly holdovers from Roosevelt, as my mother used to call him, from the Roosevelt administration, except for Clark Clifford, who was his chief of staff, supported him or agreed with Truman on that. He just runs out to the Rose Garden and did it, you know, recognized Israel. And he didn't take any advice. His only hesitancy to recognize Israel was he was told by his generals that if you recognize Israel, in 4 weeks they'll be pushed into the ocean by the Arabs. And so he was a little reluctant for that reason. But other than that, he was totally convicted by his belief in the Bible. The cussing Baptist from Missouri was influenced by the Bible. But according to his wife, Bess, he wasn't influenced in some other areas by the Bible. But nevertheless, so Turkey has said that they are going to break diplomatic relations if Israel, if the United States does what Trump says they're going to do tomorrow. And many of the Arab nations have said they're going to do stuff like, I guess, an intifada or something, you know, if Trump does this. And an Israeli diplomat earlier today said they could move the embassy in 2 minutes by simply declaring the consulate in Jerusalem to be the new embassy. And that's probably the strategy they're going to take, because that way it won't be as big a production as they're bringing bulldozers and a whole new building and all of this kind of stuff. And they'll probably eventually expand it or whatever, you know, or maybe even build a whole new thing. But nevertheless, this is a pretty important thing, because how many presidents have promised to do this? Everybody that runs for president, at least on the Republican side, you know, have promised to move the embassy, and they never do. And go ahead.
Has influenced other countries who want to do it not to do it. They pressure them not to do it.
Does Micronesia have their embassy? I bet they'll embolden them to do it. You know, in fact, we used to have our embassy in Jerusalem up until when? What was it? The 80s or something, or was it the 70s that we moved it to Tel Aviv? We originally had our embassy in Jerusalem in the past.
Before 67, I think.
Okay. Yeah, it would. Well, it could have been West Jerusalem, you know, where the Knesset was before 67. But so if you have a question about, for Randy or me, these two microphones in the back, you need to go there and start asking your questions.
And one thing I want to say about the Jerusalem issue, we've been waiting a long time for our daughter to have legitimacy. She was born in Hadassah Hospital right there in what they call East Jerusalem, but of course it's the Jewish part of Jerusalem as can be, you know, with the Hebrew University there and everything else. Nevertheless, when we went to get her passport, they put on their country of origin, Jerusalem. And we said, no, it's Israel. We don't recognize Jerusalem to be part of Israel, we were told. And that's been the same all the way through. So many people who had children born in Jewish hospitals in technically East Jerusalem have never been able to be called Israeli. Have that in their passport. So they lobby for that, they've done it, and it's been unsuccessful in most cases. Now there's a chance everybody will have that approved. So.
Go ahead, Dave.
Several years ago, the two of you came out with an excellent VHS video entitled Ready to Rebuild. And I'm wondering if you could give us an update as to the efforts of the Temple Faithful in terms of their building plans.
Yeah, we came out with a book, and Jimmy DeYoung put us in a video. Yeah,
well, we had the book first, and it wasn't published yet. Jimmy and I was doing interviews in Jerusalem. Jimmy was kind of holding the microphone for me in those days. And so when I left, I finished some of these interviews for us. We'll work together. You can do the DVD video component of this. We're doing the book. And so we advertised the video in our book. We advertised our book and the video. And Tom and I are both on that video. Let me just say, that book, in 1992 is when it came out. And it was, at the time, the first word on the rebuilding efforts and plans to rebuild the temple. Now, a lot's happened since then. I've written five different books of the temple since then. Tommy's done things as well.
This thick.
Yeah. And you can find some on the table out there. But last year pre-tip I did, or one of those years, still waiting to rebuild.
I think it was two years ago.
I did an update on all of that called Still Waiting to Rebuild, went through things. Basically, it's not in terms of artifacts or utensils, they're called clouds or vessels that they use for the temple, they've all been finished. There's nothing yet to be completed there. Other things they found, the crimson red that was used to dye the parochet, the curtain was in the Holy of Holies, the tehillah blue for garments and everything, all discovered and stuff's in process. We worked on training priests. We built a movable altar so they can move this from place to place and actually carry out a sacrificial system. They can't, of course, do it in the temple now, but they do it in certain places at certain times when we have Jewish festivals and times for this. More for demonstrating that this is something that the consciousness of Israel needs to be raised concerning and be interested in. You know, we had the revival of the Sanhedrin. It's a number of rabbis who meet together, most connected with the temple movement. It's not recognized by any Orthodox body, but they consider themselves the revived or renewed Sanhedrin. And their decisions are, of course, as soon as possible to build an altar on the Temple Mount, which would constitute already the rebuilding of the temple in their minds. But they have these other obstacles they're still wrestling with. One was the idea of how do you sanctify the people who are going to do the work if they have the ashes of the red heifer. We don't have those, so we have to have a red heifer. When you get a red heifer, it has to be 3 years of age, and then it has to be burned, and those ashes can be used.
Does it have to be born in Israel?
It has to be born in Israel because it can't have any blemish on it. It can't have worn a yoke. So some people tried early on to bring frozen embryos over. Others are trying to find red qualified heifers and bring them over and interbreed. So far, there's been no successful case. They've always sprouted a white hair or something. And you know, I said, you think we have trouble splitting hairs in archaeology? Okay. They do quite literally. But the other problem is, who's going to offer the red heifer? Because you become unclean in offering the red heifer. So you have to have a clean person. Well, there is no clean, unclean person. So they decided what they would do was they would build a compound off of the ground of Israel. It's not physically in contact with the ground. The feet never touch it. Then, if you can find a child who's born to a Kohanim, priestly family, you can raise them in this compound until they're of the proper age, or of age 12, and then they're, if they never had any medical personnel, anybody who could possibly contaminate them ritually, and that person then would be able to fall for the red heifer.
Is that
that's been in process.
Is that the Eteret Kohanim?
Yeah. No, well, Eteret Kohanim was a little different, but it's, the guy that was behind the original launching of it, I don't know who's doing what, it's kind of secretive. But there's been a number of advances. They're quietly behind the scenes moving things forward, but the political situation has prevented anything from going forward. It's only gotten worse in the temple. If you go up there, there are people who are stationed to watch to see if your lips are moving in many languages to see if you're saying anything about temple or prayer, any kind of religious affection. There's the women in black. These are Arab women who are stationed in places. And if they, yeah, they do all that kind of stuff and they start raising Cain, because if they think you are someone you shouldn't be. Sometimes they mix up Christians for Jews or whatever, and they come on. They're kids too. They just throw rocks. Got a film where this was all done while I was there. We produced another product out on the table called a virtual tour of the Temple Mount. We were concerned that tourist groups going there couldn't tour the temple. And we didn't talk about the temple. You had to leave your Bible behind. You couldn't bring pictures. You couldn't do anything. So we took 360-degree cameras, and we filmed all of this very clandestinely. Also, I spoke and taught all on the Temple Mount about things related to Yeshua and about the temple and the first and second temples. And it took us 3 years to get kicked off and came back and did more. So we did all of this, and so it's now a computer program. You can put it in your computer, and in almost like real time, you can turn around, jump the walls, go throughout the Dome of the Rock and the Temple Mount, everywhere, pull down menus and see things about the temple, see teaching on the temple, do the same thing that was happening up in the park. So that's out on the table.
And it's so realistic, they even have the Arabs up there that any time you mention temple, they'll arrest you. he's got a question.
Okay. Dr. Price, Tommy and Daryl and Robbie and I were at Yad Vashem last year, and they took us to the Temple Institute, and we were all kind of looking at each other when the statement was made, we know where the Ark of the Covenant is. Is there truth to that?
Yeah, they've never denied that they didn't know. It's based on Jewish tradition and certain texts. I wrote a couple of books in the past. Tommy knows about them. One's called Search of Temple Treasures. Harvey South published another called Searching for the Ark of the Covenant. And I interviewed them. We made also a video of this. Interviewed these same guys on those questions. At the time, with Rabbi Getz, who was the chief of the
Western Wall.
Western Wall had done the tunneling beneath the war to be looking for the Ark of the Covenant originally. Basically, long story short, they believe the Ark could never have left the Temple Mount. There's no evidence in the Bible that no one could have created it away or taken it away. Probably before the destruction of the first temple, when there was clear evidence that the temple was under siege. In 605, you had Daniel and his friends taken away. And then in 589, you had another siege and other people taken. In 586, you had the destruction of the temple. And already, Isaiah had told Hezekiah, this is going to happen because you showed the emissaries of Babylon, these treasures will be taken away someday. And then when Josiah was killed about 38 years before the destruction of the temple, it was clear that they didn't have anybody in place who was going to be able to safeguard that. And then when they saw these things happening, they believed that they secreted the ark away. They had a chamber that Solomon, from the construction of the first temple, had these underground chambers, and we know they exist. We just don't know always where, but they existed. And according to Jewish sources, one of the tractates of the Mishnah called Shekalim says that the priest in the second temple period, the ark wasn't there. The ark was long gone from there. The barren stone in the holy place, the priest would pour the blood on it. But there was no ark. But these priests were assigned to separate the moldy wood from the good wood for the sacrifices. And one of the priests, removing the wood, saw that the stones of the pavement were different. And he thought, he figured out what was going on based on some tradition he knew. It says he went to tell his friends that he had found the Ark of the Covenant was struck dead in mid-sentence. Tractate Yoma says, fire could not consume. There's all these different views. It simply says that there was some knowledge, apparently, in the Second Temple period. And they identify the place as beneath the pit of wood. There's two different things called the pin of wood, but this one was the one not near the Sanhedrin, but in a different place. And so these guys say, based on the ancient sources, we know where these clues are. We don't think it ever left. We think it was buried. And therefore, all we have to do is get to that someday and it's there. But we don't want to go too soon because you don't want to bring the Ark of the Covenant out and put it in the museum. You can't do that. There's a tourist at Gawkhead, he says. And it has to be sanctified. And the whole reason for having the temple in the first place was to house the ark. So if you have the ark, you've got to have a temple. So they're thinking in these directions. But they think it's buried beneath the rubble of two temples now, and it's safe, and it hasn't been located by them, even the Muslims. So that's their belief. So that's when they say, we know where it is. So.
And was it in the 80s or 90s that Yehuda Getz was tunneling under there?
It was 1991, yes.
Yeah.
No. You think? We could have been
80. Okay.
Because I went to the thing in 85, so
yeah.
81, he was a clandestine kind of thing. He wanted to build a synagogue and started at the upper level, clearing an area for a synagogue, and found his top of an arch and realized that it was the top of an arch that went much further down in terms of the gate. That's what's called Warren's Gate today. And so the synagogue is up there. You go into the synagogue, only men can go up there, but you can see the top of the arch. But and when they found this, they started clearing it out and they started going through it. But they were doing it at night, sworn to secrecy. There was 10 men. Gershon Solomon of the Tefnut Tape was one of those. And in the process, they didn't find me. I've got this on tape. I've talked to them. They said, we needed more time. You know, we needed at least another year in the process of doing this. They said, we thought we were close, but we were still that far away. And the reporter found out about it, said, I know what you're doing. And he begged him not to reveal the story. So if someone else finds out, I've got to get the scoop. And so someone did find out. He broke the story. The Muslims came in and invaded the tunnel. The yeshiva boys who were doing this had a big thing, entered the jail. And next day, the government patched the thing up, the hole they made, and they came and tore it down. There was back and forth thing. And eventually, they complied with the government. Yehuda Getz was the guy kind of behind that, but it was, what's the... Who was the chief rabbi at the time?
Shlomo Goren, the IDF rabbi.
It was Shlomo that wanted to do this. He wanted to blow up the Dome of the Rock too in his day. But and he basically said, "We got to comply with the government. It'll be ready when God's ready." And so they sealed it up. And initially, when you went through the Western Wall Tunnel, you saw this plaster. And then soon it became something more. And there used to be a sign that talking about the third temple, entrance to the third temple. And that got taken down. And now they made it look like it was never touched its own natural stone. And that's to, of course, you know, to keep people from asking questions they don't want to answer. But that would be the way they said it would go to find it.
Yeah, so Israel lacks the political will to take control of the Dome of the Rock, even though technically they are in control. And, of course, Moshe Dayan, a few days after the Six-Day War, gave control of it back to the Muslim Waqf, hoping to appease them. Of course, it didn't. It demonstrated weakness. But
we have three reasons for doing that. In his biography, he thinks he's taken the high ground. He's basically saying, we have sovereignty over the site. We can do what we want to. And so he thought this act of clemency to the Muslims would indicate their strength. And, of course, they take that as weakness. And so the idea was, he said, you can have jurisdiction over this site, that's the mosque and the Dome of the Rock, and then we will have jurisdiction over the Western Wall below. So the Jews below and the Arabs above, so they win. Now, the problem was, he said, I didn't really want to do it that way, but the rabbis came to me and said, we'll never go up there. It's forbidden for us to walk on the Temple Mount. We don't know where the Holy of Holies was. We think the Ark is still beneath there. If we tread on it inadvertently, we could desanctify things. We can't do that. We won't go up. So no one is allowed to ascend to the Temple Mount. So Diane said, well, you won't even go up there. Why should we, you know, go to the mat on this thing? Then they had international pressure. And no one had thought that Jesus would win in 67. There was a whole embarrassment for the Muslim world. And there was a fear they would rise up as one and come and attack, so they wanted to placate them in that way too. And the other thing was, you know, Diane actually thought that Jews could go up there and pray. He didn't think it would be closed to them. And actually Jews did go up and try to pray, and got kicked off, and then went back, and they said, well, we don't allow anyone who's a non-Muslim to come up here. So it's just, I mean, it's almost like the Shlomo Born, I talked to him while he's still alive, he said that Dayan did this as an act of his own. There was no government.
Yeah, impulse.
Corporation. He just did it. And then other people would follow after. It's just kind of, you do it, history will pick up the pieces or something. And so they just, there wasn't a lot of thought given to this.
What, didn't Yehuda Getz do some measurements up there and everything?
After 67, Getz and Gordon wrote a book on this with all the measurements. He took an Army Corps of Engineers up and started mapping the whole temple mount. But he didn't do anything underground. I asked him why. He said, well, we thought we'd be here forever. So, you know, one thing at a time. But it was only, he started doing that in July, and in August, they kicked him off. He was going to build, he had a synagogue starting, the northern part of the temple mount. And they said, it was Diane that came to get your books, get off the place. We've given this back to the Wat. And
now, briefly tell us why we know where the temple was located and why the Dome of the Rock was originally built.
Well, we know where the temple was based on.
Well, there's all these theories, you know.
The three things I said in my talk. You were waiting for that, right? Okay. So first we have the history of the Bible that gives us certain locations. And then we have the history outside of the Bible that gives those locations and speaks about it from eyewitnesses who were there for history. You can call that tradition if you want to. I simply call it history, if it was. Jews never forgot. It was always, and it was the same place, always the time. And then we have the archaeological remains, and those have been uncovered, and there's just no question.
No, I'm talking about the exact location of the temple.
The exact location.
Yeah.
Is still unknown in one sense.
Right.
There's three possible locations. But I'm just saying, first, the location is the 35-acre platform called the Temple Mount. From there, there's discussions. The temple was not built at the highest point of Mount Moriah because pagan temples were built at high points. So it was built on Mount Moriah, but not at the highest point. Now, Ezekiel's temple built at the highest point because of the old paganism, you know, to be compared to in the future. So it won't be a problem, just like it won't be a problem building steps up to the altar in Ezekiel's temple, because the Torah says don't build steps up to the altar, but we're in the new covenant, not the old covenant. There's no problem with this. So many things are different in the future. But one location would have to be the central location where the Dome of the Rock is built. Some say, well, to the west of that. Some say, well, to the east of that. And then to the north of that, there's another location which was proposed by Asher Kaufman. It's called the northern location. It's, there's some cupola there today, Muslim little dome structures called the Dome of the Tablets, the Dome of the Spirits. And people have said, well, the paving stone beneath that is different than the other stone. This is really bedrock. Well, it's not. It's been tested they've done soundings beneath it. It's simply a big slab that's there, but it's hollow underneath.
But we wrote in our book, I mean, I see.
Yeah.
Well, we wrote also from history that we had studied that the Byzantine Christians had treated the Jews for hundreds of years like dirt, you know, and piled dung, as you mentioned, on the Temple Mount. And as a result, the Jews didn't get along too well with the Byzantine Christians. So when the Muslims came, Omar came, they colluded with the Muslims to help defeat the Byzantine Christians. And as a result, there was a 10 to 15 year period of friendliness, and Omar, according to one source we have, built the Dome of the Rock to preserve the site of the temple.
Yeah, I mean, there are Muslim sources, they're quite clear about this. Well, they're Egyptian, they don't have the same baggage that some others do. But they say quite clearly that it's
638. Somewhere around there. It's a few years after Muhammad died.
5 years after Muhammad died,
yeah,
the Muslims came to Jerusalem. And then it's not until 691 that they build the Dome of the Rock. And it's not until 711 they build the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So these are all done for political purposes as well. When the Dome of the Rock was built, the belief was, in other words, this is the site of the temple. This is what Khalid Omar was looking for. This was identified by the priests. There wasn't anything else there but the site of the temple. That's what they did. And then they were concerned because the Muslims didn't have the degree of culture the Byzantines had. And they're looking at all these resplendent buildings. So they built the Dome of the Rock on a Byzantine octagonal architectural form.
Didn't they first build a wooden structure initially?
Yes. Yeah, wooden structure first and then later the other. And just like originally, within the Dome of the Rock, they had only inscriptions that said, God is one and has no son. Their intention was for this people to be a polemic against the Byzantine Christians. So don't go look at their building and say, my, how God must bless them if they have all these things. No, no, no. Come into our beautiful building and you'll see it's clear God is one and he has no son. Okay, so that's there. It wasn't until the 19th century, I understand, that the inscription from Surah 17 about Muhammad's night journey was put into the Dome of the Rock. So today it's identified with Muhammad's ascent to heaven from that spot, which was originally just a dream story and then became reality and has all kind of configurations. But that's their main thing. This is where Muhammad ascended to heaven. And,
yeah, so that's a recent development.
And now the Western Wall, the Kotel, is also Islamic because that's where he tied his celestial steed, Al-Buraq, the thing he rode to heaven. And so they have a sign that says Al-Buraq Wall. And so, you know, when Diane thought, well, the Jews will have this, and the Muslims have this, they deny it. They say it's all ours. This is where he tied his horse, and this is where he sent him to heaven, all ours. So no compromise.
So, okay, do you have an opinion of whether the temple will or could be built before the rapture?
There's nothing to stop the temple from being rebuilt
but
in a physical sense, except the political.
Right.
And that's what we all think there has to be this covenant made in order for the temple to be rebuilt. And as I look at Daniel 9, it seems to me that what ends the covenant, all right, that's made, is basically the end of sacrifice and offering in the temple, which is a result of the abomination of desolation. Because anytime you introduce something like this against Jewish ritual purity, then everything stops. And the temple is desanctified, therefore it can no longer practice. And so that's what happens there. So that's what ends the covenant. What began the covenant must be the rebuilding of the temple in some way. So I think more logically, the covenant happens and the temple is built as a consequence of that. It's sort of the Antichrist makes that possible by simply saying, you're going to have peace and you're going to have the ability to do this. And we think, it depends on where you put the God of God, the Magog,
right,
some incentives, why he does it the way he does it.
You mentioned quite a few books. I didn't know there were so many on the subject of the idea that there could be a temple built outside of the old city. I haven't heard much about it. But what I heard was is that there are Jews who are very seriously considering getting an altar built, even though they don't have a temple, and getting animal sacrifice going again, and they have everything they need to do it, and there's really nothing stopping them much except for the political problems. What do you know about that?
They've been doing what they would consider sacrifices for at least more than a decade.
So they are animal sacrifices? I didn't
even know. Yeah, there are different groups that have been doing this.
Animal sacrifices?
Yeah, animal sacrifices. I mean,
what about
pictures in our books? I've got films on it. It's great. You do it every year now.
I didn't know that.
I attended one. I watched it done one time. But It's not on the Temple Mount. It's not. It's not at the place.
Where are they doing it?
They're simply doing it nearby. There's a mountain nearby that overlooks the Temple Mount. It's one place they've done it. They've done it in the Jewish quarter, for that matter, right in front of everybody. You know, so
what about those theories? I mean, I haven't read them yet, but the idea that they could be wrong about where the temple was, Shiloh,
well,
is where it was originally. And all.
I gave you about half an hour
I saw
of an hour and a half presentation we did on this.
Yes.
Which we sell. You can get a copy of it through our ministry.
Right.
And most, that all archaeologists of note will not address this problem. They say it's ridiculous, it's nonsense, they won't even dignify it. And because I'm an evangelical and it's fellow evangelicals that come up with this, I feel duty now to respond. And I wasn't even responding because I was invited to a conference to respond to another person who gave that view. And so I had to do the work and study. There's so much more that, will argue the case. Both from the scriptures as well.
What about the theory that the millennial temple may not be in Jerusalem?
Well,
it may be in Shiloh.
Where would it be?
Shiloh.
Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe it's the city.
Jerusalem will change. And
yeah.
Will remain on its site.
Well, someone has mentioned Shiloh being. Since
that's the third temple, not the fourth.
I meant the,
we saw Ezekiel's temple.
Ezekiel.
Well, that's the fourth temple.
Well, whatever. We know what number. Final temple
in Shiloh, is that, what do you think about
no.
that?
In Shiloh?
No. That would be the third temple that they're talking about being in Shiloh.
Yeah.
The next one, let's call it that.
Oh, is that? Oh, that's what
they're That's saying. What they're saying, and there's just no basis for it.
Okay.
You can't have a functioning temple where the functioning temple once was. It's just not possible.
Because God decreed that it would be built there in the Bible.
Yeah. Okay. That's all.
Yeah, it's just a question. When after the Exodus, the Jews were wandering the desert, and they had a holy of holy, and they had tents. Would that be considered a temple, or does it have to be built on the Temple Mount?
Well, the term they would use would be a sanctuary. Midrash. Okay. So, the Mishkan is the term used for tabernacle. It means a place of dwelling.
Okay.
From the verb shikan, to dwell. And so the idea is simply, here we have a place where God is with his people. And the Shekinah glory was with them, traveled with them. And when it stopped, they put up the tabernacle and made resident above the Holy of Holies.
Right. The other question.
The town meeting that was nearby, in which then Joshua or Moses were invited around to commune with God. It's a separate place, not the same as the
Well, wouldn't you argue that the Garden of Eden was a sanctuary as well?
I have a book.
Right, I know. But
I remember, I don't know if Wayne's still here. Wayne. When I started writing this book, I was writing, he said, what's taking you so long writing that book? And I said, well, I'm writing on the temple in Genesis. And he says, that's why it's taking so long. There's no temple in Genesis. And I thought, well, yeah, you're right. But there's sanctuary symbolism there. In other words, God had the concept coming to the Garden of Eden to create a sacred holy place. And the verbs that are used for the work of Adam are only used for the high priest. There's many interesting parallels that you find there. So, he starts the concept there of a place to meet with him. It's set apart, and that can't be realized again after the fall until we come to Mount Sinai, and a mediator takes that role and fulfills it. So,
my other question was, up in Liberty, you have like a museum and stuff. Is that open to the public?
We have a Liberty Biblical Museum, about 3,000 artifacts, all from Israel, primarily Israel. And there's a whole exhibit on the temple, the Last Supper, many things like this, Dead Sea Scroll exhibits, and other things.
Got a bunch of coins.
Bunch of coins.
Swords and knives from back in the day.
All that kind of stuff. We even have a full Roman soldier that came from the Ben Hur movie. We got MGM Studios, and it's the original outfit on the mannequin. That's pretty nice. But all this stuff is available to the public, but it's hours from 9 to 5, each day except Saturday. So if you come, you're welcome to the friend. That's where I hang my hat. I don't know. It's some guy.
Hi. I'm a fairly new studying prophecy, so maybe my questions are elementary, but so I didn't know who to ask. With the 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel, what makes a prophetic year 360 days?
In other words, he's wanting to know why they use a 360-day year versus 365 and a quarter. Because, Charlie, could you explain that? Why there's a 360-day year in the 70 weeks of Daniel versus 365?
Yeah. It's a lunar.
They're following the lunar calendar.
Which the Jews still follow today. That's why they have leap month. And in Genesis, everything is 360-day years. And I've heard Charlie teach that in the 6th century, you had the slowdown. You could have had a slowdown somewhere in the 6th century. That's where everybody began to make calendar adjustments. So it's, and that's where we get 360 degrees and a circumference and all of that kind of stuff. And so some have even speculated that a year might return to 360-day year during the tribulation for some reason. Doesn't have to, but the 70 weeks are figured based on 360-day years multiplied by the number of years. Come up with 183 or 73,000 days or something, you know, and you can figure it all out. Yeah, I've got articles on it and everything. I just don't always remember it off the top of my head.
Thank you so much. And one more question. In your gentleman's... I'm sorry?
Go ahead. No.
Okay, sorry. In your estimation, like, what's the best way to understand the 10 horns and 7 heads in Revelation 13? And if they are empires or countries, like, do you guys think that they're from the UN or the EU or from both?
Well, the best way to understand it is the right way. But I think the 7, is it horns? Yeah. 7 heads?
10 horns, 7 heads.
Yeah, 10 horns, of course, represent the 10, because it says in Daniel, you know, I kept looking and, you know, I focused in on the last beast or whatever, you know. And so it's describing the 10. I think that is a 10-nation confederacy that revives the Roman Empire and goes global the second half. Some people think that it refers to 10 regions of the world, you know, but I don't think that fits the history that's already happened. It's not continuous with the history that already happened, you see. But those are the two main views, and I think it's the revived Roman Empire through which the Antichrist comes. What's the 7? Is it horns or crowns or
7
heads? Thank you, yes. 7 heads. And I think that refers to the 7 empires that have persecuted Israel down through history, starting with Egypt, who obviously persecuted the Jews with the Exodus events, then going to, Syria, yeah. And that refers to the northern kingdom being taken off. Then it picks up in Daniel with Babylon, with the Jews there in, from Judah, the southern kingdom. And then you have the Medo-Persians, Esther, and all of that attempt to kill the Jews from which they're delivered. And then you have the Greeks and Antiochus Epiphanes and the Romans, which is when the book of Revelation was written, and the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And it goes on in Revelation 17 and talks that there's 7. So 6 were, it says, that those are the ones that I just mentioned. The 7th in the future is the revived Roman Empire, the Antichrist. And the 8th, I believe, is the Antichrist who is killed and revived in the second half of the tribulation. That's the 8th.
Do you think that, and thank you. Yeah, I didn't know. Thank you so much. And so Do you generally think that maybe these empires are involved in the UN or the EU or both right now? Could they come from?
I would argue that this is not a fulfillment. The UN is not a fulfillment, but it's probably a preparation for fulfillment. And so whenever the balloon goes up, a little military lingo there, and the tribulation starts, then there will be a 10-nation confederacy. And it says that seven will be persuaded verbally to join them, and then they will militarily take over three, equaling 10. And so this is not a fulfillment today, but it's probably a preparation for a beginning of the revived Roman Empire, because the fourth kingdom in Daniel, the Roman Empire, is never defeated. It makes a big point out of how the first three are defeated and replaced by the subsequent kingdom. And so this just fades away. And so American culture is part of that Roman European culture over here, you know, with Christian influences and all that kind of thing. So in some way, we're probably related. We're not part of the 10-nation confederacy, but somehow we're related, probably. That's a guess.
I know there's tremendous tension in Jerusalem and on the Temple Mount.
Could you speak louder?
Yes, I know there's tremendous tension in Jerusalem and on the Temple Mount, but I'm curious, have you had to deal with overt occult or supernatural activity or resistance? Demonic activity is what I'm getting at.
You know, spiritual warfare is everywhere, and it's more intense there than perhaps many of the places. So, you know, it's how you interpret it. I mean, if you can look at the actors who are perpetrating it, but behind it, we know there's other forces. And I've seen some very, maybe strange things happen, but, you know, if your view is that Islam is, of course, not just a pagan religion, but a religion that is motivated by satanic purpose itself, then you can see what's being done, certainly, you know, always in a sense in that way. So, there's a lot of fanaticism, a lot of other things there, so it's very hard to beat it in terms of, you know, I mean, I see everything as spiritual. I mean, everything is in the decision. We don't separate in a dichotomous way our world from the spiritual world. God's involved in everything. There's always this unseen world out there.
Yeah, there's no doubt if you read Revelation 12 about the spiritual warfare going on behind the scenes. And Revelation 12, I think, relates to the outworking of the struggle between seed the serpent and seed the woman. And so it gives you part of things that have happened in the past in order to set the stage for the final drama of how the seed of the serpent is going to be defeated by the seed of the woman. And so that is a whole chapter dealing with spiritual warfare prophetically. And then, of course, the whole book of Revelation and all of those other prophetic passages, you know, Satan and God are out there duking it out, you see, and humans are involved and angels. You know, book of Revelation, all of a sudden you come to this world where angels are all over the place in the future. It's not the way it is today. In spite of the movies and things that they make and all of that kind of stuff today, it's more of a clandestine influence, but it'll be more direct during the tribulation. Go ahead.
This is a quick question. We know all of Israel wants peace, but how many or what type of Jews in the nation of Israel want the temple built or don't want the temple built? Is there a distinction? I'm familiar with the Mosaic Jews who are often praying at the Western Wall, and they're the ones that are looking for a Messiah to still come. That doesn't mean everyone in Israel is, though. Correct?
Yeah, let's just say from the Orthodox Jews.
Yeah,
only
Orthodox, yeah.
All Orthodox Jews believe the temple will be rebuilt.
It won't be rebuilt, yeah.
Now, those who are active in supporting the temple movement is a smaller number.
Okay.
That's been growing somewhat. There's even been some ultra-Orthodox or Hasidic Jews who normally have a different view. Their view is the temple comes down fully formed with fire from heaven.
Like New Jerusalem?
They actually believe that the temple never was destroyed, that it was actually taken by God to heaven and will come back that way. But there are many of those who are now coming toward the temple movement. When you're talking about secular Jews, those don't identify with either, you know, ultra-Orthodox or Orthodox or conservative or reform.
They think they're living in Miami Beach and Tel Aviv. Yeah.
But the ones in Israel and many other places, too, have begun to change their view, too, because it's more of a political thing. We are a sovereign state. Jerusalem is our capital. That's being denied to us. The Temple Mount is the center of our history. This is where our people should be able to pray. They're denied access to it. These type of things become an affront, and they want to correct that. And so they support it on that basis, that we should have this right. You know, there are others, of course, who oppose it because they're concerned about peace. They said we can't have peace if we provoke the Muslims. So you have, just like in our country, we have people all over the board.
Yeah, you get various groups.
Motivating factors.
Right.
But on the whole, since the temple movement began in 87, right after the first intifada, there's been a slow increase of people, you know, coming on board.
I see.
But by no means is this what the nation thinks. We don't know, because right now, any attempt to go on the Temple Mount is considered a violation.
Act of war.
Act of war, yeah. And would cause repercussions. So most Israelis simply say, I want to have no peace. I would get up, take my kid to school, pick him up from school, and realize he had been blown up or something else had happened. We want normal life. We can't have that if we keep provoking others. So this is more peace. Of course, we don't always realize that it won't ever happen. Can't happen, because what's hated is not they're going to the temple, not that they're Jews, but they exist at all. Okay, as if they're not a divvy, and they exist as second class people of the book. If they exist as Zionists who have control over Muslims in an independent and sovereign way, that's unacceptable. Always will be. So can't go further.
Well, I read an interesting article in the Jerusalem Post about a year ago based on a poll of Israelis, and it said 73% of, I guess you'd say, millennials in Israel are conservative, on the conservative side. Now, conservative in Israel means you're a Zionist, because they've had for the last, I don't know, 30 years, this thing called post-Zionism. And, you know, that's the left who thinks they should have a democracy with everybody equal, you know, and all of this kind of stuff. But it appears the younger people are getting more involved in religion, coming out of secular areas, than not, based on this poll.
For instance, one of the leaders of the temple movement was now in the Knesset.
Right, the red-haired guy.
Yeah, red-haired guy. We got shot.
Right.
But, yeah, so it, you know, there's some influence out there, too, that they haven't had before.
Yeah, and so this is trending, you know, where they're going to be stronger and stronger in maintaining Zionism. But Zionism, you know, has been around for a long time, but the basis for Zionism keeps shifting, you know, the rationale for having a Jewish state. That's what Zionism means and refers to. And Israel is supposed to be a Jewish state with a democracy. See, that's hard to balance. You know, how democratic are you going to be versus how Zionist are you going to be? You see what I'm saying? And so they have a spectrum politically, and many of the secular people in Haifa and Tel Aviv, etc., they want democracy. You know, they want to make a lot of money and go to the beach and do all, and they don't want to be under the jurisdiction of the Sabbath laws that the Orthodox keep imposing, etc.
The real issue is when it is possible to build a temple, when there is a covenant signed, well, everybody should get on board. Well, we have no obstacle. We have no problems. You know, there's no difficulty to doing this now, so why not? You know, it's a symbol of our nationalism, so we can do it. And who knows, by the time we get past the rapture and other things, where things will be, you know, in terms of the religious thinking in Israel, too. You know, it's in Isaiah 66, if you study those first verses, there are apparently two groups that actually go and worship in the rebuilt temple. One are Orthodox Jews. The others are apparently believing Jews, Messianic Jews, because that's the place to go. But they're ostracized by their brethren. These guys are only looking at sacrifices in terms of the sacrifices, not in the way God intended them to be in terms of true obedience. So there's kind of a drama going on there. It's kind of happening. So you're seeing almost a spectrum of Jewish belief represented in the temple then.
Okay, thank you all. I'm going to ask if Greg Allen would lead us in closing prayer here as we shut things down for the night.
All right. Let's pray together. Father, it's been a long but a wonderful, just blessed day. We thank you for your goodness. Thank you for your hand of anointing and leading on the hearts and minds of our speakers. We thank you for each presentation, and we pray that we take from this day the richness that falls from your Holy Spirit upon each of their life's work and ministry. And we are so grateful, Father, that you have shared them as your servants with us today. We pray for rest tonight, Father. For those who will be traveling even early in the morning and missing the session, we pray for them for safety. Father, would you continue to lead us as we seek to serve you with whole and undivided hearts. And may we rest in your grace tonight. In Jesus' name.